Okay, we're going to go back on the record now. Day two, May 31st. Mr. Sanderson is still going forward with MDU's case in chief, case number PU-17-295. Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you, Judge. Montana Dakota would call Dr. Stephen Gaskey.
Dr. Gaskey, you were here yesterday when I gave the perjury admonition. Okay. Would you raise your right hand, please? You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Dr. Gaskey. Could you please state your full name and business address?
My name is J. Stephen Gaskey, and my address is 1300 19th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C.
And Dr. Gaskey, whom are you employed by?
Concentric Energy Advisors.
And what does Concentric Energy Advisors do?
We are an energy and utility consulting firm. We do economic and financial consulting for companies, mergers and acquisitions, various rate case work, planning, forecasting.
And Dr. Gaskey, could you just provide a brief overview of your educational background?
I have a bachelor's degree from the University of Virginia, an MBA in finance from George Washington University, and a PhD in from Indiana University, where my major field of study was public utility economics and a supporting field in finance.
And could you just provide us an overview of your work experience?
I have worked with regulated utilities for approximately 40 years now, mostly as in a consulting role. For a few years, I taught public utilities at Indiana University, and then was a finance professor at Trinity University. But throughout that time, I was consulting with public utilities.
And Dr. Gaskey, what is your personal area of expertise?
I usually say it several things, but all of them are related to public utility economics and regulation. They include finance and various economic matters.
And in your professional career, Dr. Gaskey, have you had the opportunity to testify in other proceedings before state regulatory bodies?
Yes.
Can you just give us
probably something a little more than 125 proceedings at this point.
And Dr. Gaskey, are you familiar with Montana Dakota's application for a natural gas rate increase in this case?
Yes.
And what was your involvement in the application process?
I was asked to conduct a study on the required rate of return for the company.
Okay. And before we get into that, Dr. Gaskey, you filed pre-filed direct and rebuttal testimony in this proceeding?
I did.
Okay. Now, I asked this question, but if you were asked the same questions in your pre-filed testimony, would your answers remain the same?
I do need to make a correction, and that would be in my direct testimony. I believe that's Exhibit MDU-1 on page 30, footnote 23.
Could you just describe what you'd like to change on that?
Certainly. At the end of the first sentence in footnote 23, I need to add a clause, except that I omitted companies with negative growth rates.
Okay. Now,
and then I have a second one. On my rebuttal testimony, which I believe is MDU-2, on page 38, footnote 41, I have essentially the same change.
Okay. The same footnote you used in on both your direct and rebuttal?
Yes. They're slightly different. But,
okay. Now, Dr. Gaske, have you prepared PowerPoint slides regarding your presentation today?
Yes.
And as we move forward, feel free to use those slides in your presentation. But just kind of to begin with, Dr. Gaske, based upon your analysis in this case, what did you determine to be the appropriate rate of return and return on equity for Montana Dakota?
10%.
Okay. Can you explain to the commissioners why this is rate of, or first, why rate of return is important to the company in a rate case?
Rate of return is important because it's the return to the investors who supply the capital, and the capital is an essential input for a public utility, and the capital has a cost to it, just like the salaries and wages of the employees. The investors need to be compensated for the capital that they provide.
And Dr. Gaske, can you explain how you arrived at the appropriate rate of return in this case?
Yes. There are several methods that you use to try to determine an appropriate cost of capital, but in general, I began by selecting proxy companies, other natural gas distribution companies. I had to use large publicly traded ones that have enough information about forecasted growth rates. They have to be publicly traded so that you have stock prices to examine. I use that to determine a zone of reasonableness. And then I need to compare the Montana Dakota, North Dakota gas operations to those proxy companies to determine where in the zone of reasonableness they should be placed. Although the proxy companies are all natural gas distribution companies, none of them is exactly like North Dakota or the North Dakota gas operation. So an important step in the process is that placement within the zone. So that's the process, general process I went through.
Can you explain the methods used to determine the cost of common equity equity capital?
Yes, there are several methods that are commonly used. Probably the most common method is the discounted cash flow method. That involves determining the dividend yield of a utility and adding an expected future growth rate to it. The dividend yield is simply the current annual dividend that the company is paying divided by its stock price. And then the expected future growth rate is usually based on analyst estimates, and you can use other methods for determining a growth rate. Another method that's often used is the risk premium method. With that, you look at what the current bond yields are, and you add a premium for the additional risk of common equity. And so you have various ways that you might determine an equity risk premium and how much to add to the bond yield. The capital asset pricing model is also commonly used. I would say it's less used by commissions, but you'll see it in textbooks quite a bit. In this case, I used what I call an unbiased capital asset pricing model, but the general idea is that you start with a bond yield and you add a risk premium to it. But in the capital asset pricing model, the risk premium that you add is a very specific formula, and that's that you look at the average risk premium that is being required by all the stocks in the market, and then you adjust it up or down based on the risk of the individual company that you're looking at. So, for example, if a company has and beta, what you see in the formula there, that measures the how sensitive that stock price is to changes in the general market. If you have a beta of one, that means that a company, their stock price will go up by 10% if the general stock market goes up by 10%. If you have a beta of 0.7, it means that your stock price would only go up 7% if the stock market went up by 7%. So you use the beta times the market risk premium to determine the cost of equity. And in this particular case, I also added a size risk premium. Duff and Phelps, who now publishes a series on returns on common equity, has data on the risk premium that they recommend that you add if you're doing a capital asset pricing model and adjust. They found that the capital asset pricing model tends to be biased based on the size of the company, that it doesn't come up with good answers or correct answers, and so you adjust it for the size, and in general, the smaller the company, the larger the size premium that you need. Finally, another approach is the comparable earnings approach, and that is to look at the actual earnings of other companies and in particular, companies that have similar risks, so that you know that that this particular company could compete for capital against those companies and what they earn.
And Dr. Gaske, can you explain the results of your cost of equity studies?
Certainly. I conducted a couple of DCF analyses. The first one I did was what I refer to as a basic DCF analysis, and that has the dividend yield plus the growth rates that investment analysts are forecasting for each of the companies. So I had my group of proxy companies and conducted that. The high company in the group came in at 11.8%. The median at 9.2, and the low was at 7.1. I also conducted a blended growth rate DCF analysis, where, again, I used a dividend yield plus a growth rate. But in this case, I averaged the analyst growth rate forecasts with an estimate of what I'd call a sustainable growth rate based on the amount of earnings that the company is retaining and reinvesting in the company and the external stock issuances. So it takes into consideration both the analyst and the amount of reinvestment or investment that the company is doing. In this case, I got a high of 10.8, a median of 9.1, and a low of 7.9. Now, I should say one thing, and I'll talk more about this later, is that within that range, obviously Montana, Dakota, North Dakota Gas is not necessarily the same as all of those companies. In addition, you probably saw in my testimony that in recent years, there's been a question as to whether the DCF results have been kind of held down by the Federal Reserve policies that have been trying to push money into the market, drive interest rates down, and have more or less induced investors who might normally invest in short-term debt or treasury bonds, they've been buying utility stocks for the dividend. FERC in particular a few years ago determined that because of the Federal Reserve policies, the DCF approach currently is coming in with somewhat low results. One of the other approaches that I did was a gas utility risk premium. And with this approach, I looked at what kind of premium commissions have allowed on bond yields over the last 25 years. And I did an analysis of that and determined more or less a formula for what the appropriate risk premium should be based on different levels of bond yields. When I did this with natural gas distribution utilities, I came out with 10% as the current indicated risk premium. The CAPM approach that I used, you can see here, it also had a range between 10.7 and 12.2% and a median of 11.3%. Finally, if you're looking at comparable earnings, Value Line, which is a widely used investment publication, it reviews about 760 companies every quarter or on a rotating basis every quarter. They forecast what return on equity various companies are likely to earn in the next few years. For the natural gas distribution utilities in my proxy group, the median for the group was 10%, and the range was between 9.5 at the low end and 11.5 at the high end. So in essence, because for two reasons, looking at my DCF analyses, I believe that Montana, Dakota, North Dakota gas operations should have a return above the median, both because of its higher risk, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, and because of the Federal Reserve policies. I thought that I'm quite certain it should be above the median, and I landed on the results of the gas risk premium analysis as the point that would be most appropriate.
And Dr. Gaske, can you discuss the gas utility risk premiums?
Yes. This is a table. I apologize for all the detail on it, but what it really is it graphs the allowed rates of return over the last 25 years for gas utilities. And on the horizontal axis, you have the 30-year U.S. Treasury bond yields at various times. And on the vertical axis, going up and down, you have how much of a premium above the bond yield was implicit in the commission allowance at that time. So if you look way over to the right corner, you'll see the returns had at a time when U.S. Treasury bonds were yielding 7.5-8%, commissions were allowing risk premiums in the 3-4% range. And essentially, you would add 3-4% to whatever the Treasury bond yields are on the horizontal axis. And in more recent times, on the left-hand side, you'll see that the bond yields are very, very low, but the risk premiums went up. With that data, I calculated a line of best fit, essentially a regression equation, which is that line through there, and it shows that there's a strong relationship between the level of Treasury interest rates and the level of risk premiums that commissions allow. And there's an equation there for it. So I use that equation, and where we are right now is that U.S. Treasury bonds are at exceptionally low levels, basically commissions have been allowing lower rates of return overall, but the risk premium that they've been allowing has been much higher than it was, say, 20, 25 years ago. So I use that regression equation to plug in what the current bond yield is and to determine what the risk premium should be for a gas utility.
And can you explain the relative risk analysis you performed and how it affects Montana Dakota's ROE?
Certainly. There are three general categories of risk that investors look at. By far the most important one is business risk. In the case of Montana Dakota's North Dakota operations, I determined that they were above average relative to the companies in my proxy group. They tend to have slower customer growth, but most importantly, these operations are extremely small compared to the proxy companies, which suggests higher risk. And you have a relatively undiversified economy. That's primarily based on agriculture, mining, and in recent years, above all, the oil industry. So it's not a highly diversified economy relative to what you see with the proxy companies. And as we all know, the oil industry is prone to boom and bust cycles that pose greater risk. With regard to financial risk, that has primarily to do with the capital structure of the company, how much debt that it takes on. The more debt that it takes on, the riskier the common equity is. In this case, the company has pretty much average an average capital structure compared to the proxy companies and an average amount of financial risk. And the last area that's typically important for public utilities is regulatory risk. The regulatory climate is typically, it is rated by an outfit called Regulatory Research Associates. And they rate North Dakota as an average slash one, so it's a slightly above average commission from the standpoint of investors. In terms of regulatory risk, it would have slightly below average regulatory risk. I mentioned the size question, and I've got a couple of slides that just give you a general idea of how small the Montana Dakota gas operations are relative to the proxy companies that I used in my analysis. You can see the circled in red in the lower right-hand corner there is the size of the MDU North Dakota gas operations in terms of assets as compared with the proxy companies, and it's extremely tiny. The second measure I used was the operating income of the companies, and again, you can see that the North Dakota gas operations really aren't even in the same category as the other companies. It's extremely small. The ideal would be to find other proxy companies that are in the same size category. The problem with that is that there aren't any that have publicly traded common stock. that you can use for your analysis, and you don't have analyst growth rate forecasts and things like that. So your second best choice is to use other natural gas distribution companies that are not in the same size category, but they do have the financial information you need. So you use them as a starting point, and then you take off from there to determine where, say, the Montana, Dakota, North Dakota operations would rate relative to those other companies. Moody's is a well-known bond rating agency. I am sure everybody's familiar with them. And when they talk about utilities and the size and diversity risk that they consider when they're looking at the risk of a utility, they talk about economic diversity, which is typically a function of the population, the size and breadth of the territory, and the types of businesses that drive its GDP and employment. As I said before, the population that is served by these North Dakota gas operations is not particularly large compared to the population of the proxy companies. Local economy is very much tied to oil and agriculture, not a, you know, there are lots of other kinds of businesses, but the, you know, if you're talking about grocery stores and shops and housing market and things like that, the really big drivers of the economy for those individuals, those kinds of businesses are oil and agriculture. And so the North Dakota operations are exposed to more than average risk there. They also talk about the size of the territory, the number of customers and the volumes. And those are not at all large relative to the proxy companies. And Moody's also says they look at the number of sizable metropolitan areas and the economic diversity, concentration in particular areas or industries. In as far as sizable metropolitan areas, my proxy group typically has companies that serve very large cities in the Montana, Dakota service territory. You've got some good sized cities, but nothing like the proxy companies. For example, you've got Bismarck that has about 70,000 people. That's by far the largest. You have Minot, which is maybe a little under 50,000, and then you've got a handful of ones that are in the 20,000s: Dickinson, Jameson, Mandan, Williston, and then probably the other 65 or so towns that it serves are under 5,000. So it's mostly small towns, not large diversified metropolitan areas. So that those same considerations are why I consider this jurisdiction, this company, to have above average risk relative to the proxy companies. I mentioned the Federal Reserve policies. That probably the most important indicator of that is on this slide. The vertical bars that you see are for about the last 10 years what the utility dividend yields have been. And you can see that they were up around 4% a number of years ago before the Federal Reserve kicked in with its policy of quantitative easing and lowering of interest rates. And since then, they declined fairly substantially down to about 2.5%, 2.5%. 2.7%. That would not be significant or in and of itself, except that you can see the blue line that goes through the middle there is the dividend yield of the S&P 500 companies. They stayed very steady throughout that time period. You don't see a precipitous drop in those. And that is an indicator that people were moving into utilities as substitutes for bonds, but not necessarily for the the ability to put pipe and mains in the ground. They just wanted that dividend on a short term basis. That's the other consideration I had.
And Dr. Gaske, how does your recommended rate of return compare to the recent range of authorized returns in contested cases by state regulatory bodies?
In the last 3 months, Regulatory Research Associates collects data on these authorized returns. They have essentially ranged between 9.3 and 9.8%, with a median at around 9.7%. That's the latest information on what other commissions have been allowing.
And Dr. Gaske, you talked about the comparable proxy companies, and am I correct? There's very little disagreement between you and the other experts that are going to testify at ROE with respect to the proxy companies?
There are some differences, but not really major differences.
With respect to the rate of return you propose, how does that compare to the rate of return for future value line projections for those comparable proxy companies that the experts in this case have selected?
Well, I talked before about the value line projections of what they think the proxy companies are likely to earn in the next few years. And that comparable earnings is one of the important considerations of will the company be in a position to compete for capital on reasonable terms. You can see that actually the first three on the list are expected to have a return on equity of about 11.5% in the next few years. Others are lower, 10, 9.5. So the range is between 9.5 and 11.5, and the average in that group is 10.5.
And just to be clear, Dr. Gaske, this isn't a table you created. This is published by Value Line?
I took the data from Value Line.
And what was the date of that publication? December 1, 2017. Is that the footnote?
Yes.
Okay. And Dr. Gaske, you've had the opportunity to review the ROE analysis of the other experts for advocacy staff and the interveners in this case. Can you just briefly summarize the areas of disagreement?
Certainly. There are a lot of kind of technical issues that we disagree on. With regard to Dr. Griffin, he initially filed recommending 8.91%, but in his SIR rebuttal testimony, he revised that to 9.23%. Where I would disagree with him is that 9.23% is the median DCF result for his proxy companies. And as I've explained, I think that the Montana, Dakota, North Dakota operations require a return above the median. So that's probably the biggest difference. With regard to Mr. Gorman, he recommends 9.1%. It's based on a composite of three different approaches. I think I indicate in my rebuttal testimony that his risk premium approach I disagree with, and if you correct it for what I think he should have done, that approach would have come out at 10.0%. One of the other issues that we disagree on is whether there should be a flotation cost adjustment in the DCF analysis. Mr. Gorman says there should not be a flotation cost adjustment at all. Dr. Griffin says that it should be a flotation cost adjustment, but you only make that adjustment to the dividend yield portion of the DCF model. And I make the flotation cost adjustment to the entire DCF rate of return. I should say I have made a flotation cost adjustment to the DCF rate of return, but there's not a flotation cost adjustment in the other methods that I relied on.
Dr. Gaskey, I have no further questions. Thank you for your time. And at this time, Your Honor, we'd offer MDU Exhibit 14, the Dr. Gaskey's PowerPoint slides.
Any objection?
No objection.
No.
No objection.
No objection. Thanks.
Exhibit MDU 14 will be received. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Dr. Gaskey, I'll start off where you left off. We've got three experts talking about this issue throughout this hearing, and it seems they've all used a little bit different methods. Is that fair?
That's correct.
So there's some subjectivity to coming up with the ROE, a return?
Yes.
Okay. And you're usually hired by companies, correct?
Yes.
How many times have you testified or filed testimony for MDU before or one of its related companies?
I don't know exactly, but probably on the order of about 30 times.
In your slides, you talk about a zone of reasonableness. Zone of reasonableness, what is that?
Well, it's a zone in which the results of your analyses fit. And it can be a very wide range, but normally to be outside the zone of reasonableness means that you're suggesting or adopting a rate of return that is either above or below anything that your studies indicate.
What is your zone of reasonableness in this case?
Well, I always start with the DCF analysis as the zone, but it's a very wide range. But then you try to look at a variety of factors to settle into.
I understand that from your testimony, but just what is the zone? It would be 9.2, which is the median of the DCF on slide 4.
Well, that wouldn't be the zone. The zone would probably run from 7.1 to 11.8. So it's a very wide zone, and so you have to find something within the zone.
Okay, see what this. So the zone is what? Are you saying the zone is the DCF analysis?
Well, that's what I usually start with as the zone of reasonableness. It's FERC uses the term zone of reasonableness all the time, and it uses that definition.
Your 10% would fall in the upper portion of that zone of reasonableness.
That's correct.
Help me understand your gas utility risk premium. As I understood that, and I'm looking at slide 4, as I understood that, that was something you came up with?
Well, yes, I did that analysis. It's something that is in the finance literature as looking at historical risk premiums and trying to relate them statistically to bond yields.
And from that you calculated the equation on slide 5.
That's correct.
And that's not an equation you go out and get from some publication or something.
No, I calculated that.
Now, moving on to slide 7 now, and we'll come back to some of these things. I just want to get through your slides first. Slide 7 and 8. As I understand it, you're just assessing MDU's North Dakota gas component.
That's correct.
If you used MDU Resources, Inc., where would it fall on these slides?
Probably somewhere in the middle, but I haven't made that comparison. They're not really relevant to the analysis.
And that would be the same for slide 8? It would increase to be somewhere in the middle?
Probably. I could get you a specific number if you need it.
So it's your testimony is just completely irrelevant to consider the parent company?
Well, for setting the rate of return, you do it on a standalone basis for the local operations and the risks that are inherent in those local operations as an investment. It really doesn't matter who owns them.
You're aware that MDU is part of MDU Resources, Inc., correct?
That's correct.
It has four other or three other brother/sister companies that are in the gas distribution business?
Yes.
Shares employees with those companies?
Yes.
Shares technology with those companies?
Yes. But it doesn't share risks.
You've got a chart in here now that is, do you have your rebuttal testimony available to you up there as well?
Yes.
So you've got a chart in here that is on, I think it's the last chart, page 11, or page 12. I'm looking at the chart on page 11 first. And as I understand it, those are commission-determined ROEs allowed between January and May of 2018. I'm sorry, I'm on your slides. I'm still in your slides.
I'm sorry. I was looking
at
your
rebuttal
testimony.
But I'm going to use it with your rebuttal testimony.
Yes. Let me go back one. Yes.
And so this is commission-determined ROEs from January to May of this year.
That's correct.
Do you know if those are litigated or settled cases?
Those are all litigated cases. None of them are settlements.
And none of those have reached an ROE that is 10%. Is that correct?
That's correct.
In your rebuttal testimony, on chart 1, which is on page, I believe, 5 of your rebuttal testimony?
Yes.
What is that chart?
That is the authorized returns on equity that were reported by Regulatory Research Associates.
And is that in litigated and settled cases or just litigated?
I believe it's all the ones that they captured.
So it include everything?
Yes.
And on that one, in your testimony, you indicate that there were 10 higher than yours total.
Yes, sir. I'm not sure I said 10. Let me take a look.
You can.
That looks like about the right number, 9 or 10.
And the median in that range is 9.55, correct?
Yes.
You look at
over that 2-year period. Over that 2-year period.
And could you give us an idea? What is the effect of your small size adjustment?
Well, the effect is that I selected a rate of return that was above the median for the DCF analyses.
And in your rebuttal testimony, you indicated smaller companies generally face greater risk due to a limited size of market, correct?
Would you repeat that?
Due to a limited size of market?
Oh, yes. Reasons? Yes.
Leaving them more vulnerable to a downturn in their local economy?
That's correct.
Do you know if MDU has experienced a downturn?
Yes.
Okay. How much of a downturn?
Essentially, when the oil boom ended, there was a downturn in the market.
Is that coming back?
Yes. It's somewhat common for the oil industry to go through boom and bust.
And it says you may have in the small size is supported by having inadequate resource to adapt to changing markets and technologies in the future.
That's correct.
Or may lack economies of scale.
That's correct.
But they do share technology and employees with three other gas distribution companies, correct?
That's correct.
And they do get support from MDU Resources, Inc., correct?
Yes.
And then you say that leaves them more vulnerable to competitive alternatives.
Yes.
MDU is a monopolistic gas distribution service in the territories it serves, correct?
Well, it depends on what you mean by monopoly. They are the only ones who can distribute natural gas, but you've got processing plants churning out natural gas liquids, propane. People can switch to electric heating, fuel oil. It faces a competitive market in all of those things.
Do you have any evidence that their MDU is losing business to those markets in any significant degree?
Not at this time, but you can look at history over decades and see that different fuels come and go and have different primacy. Right now, gas is the premium. It's probably the most economical of the fuels.
And they're not currently losing business to those alternatives?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
And nothing that you can point to that says I expect them to in the next couple years?
No, but investors, when they invest in a company that's putting investments in the ground for 30, 40, 50 years, they're aware that this is not a monopoly business in terms of gas being the only fuel available to potential customers.
And MDU also provides electric service, correct?
That's correct.
And the vast majority of their electric and gas service territories overlap.
That's correct. But I should say, if customers switched to electric and suddenly made their gas business uneconomic, I don't think that this commission would allow MDU to come in and say, we need to raise our electric rates in order to recover our gas investment. Their gas investment has to stand on its own, and it would be a loss.
And if that change happened, then the gas company would come in for a rate issue as well, correct?
Well, if you get enough competition, it becomes a vicious cycle because so much of their cost is fixed. At some point, they would start losing customers and additional customers the more they kept raising their rates.
At some point, which there's no evidence will happen in the near future.
No, but, in the natural gas pipeline industry, traditionally, they were thought of as monopolies. Many of them are still monopolies, but over the last 25 years, many of them have had to deeply discount their rates. Many of them cannot recover their costs, even though when they were built, they were assumed to be monopolies and risk-free, but they now face
Montana, Dakota.
Now, and that's the point, that's the potential.
Well, Moving on, in your rebuttal testimony, you talk about a Moody's publication from January of 2018 on page 12. And that's actually in relation to the Tax Cuts and Job Act, correct?
Yes.
And you're recommending some ways to stabilize companies as a result of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, correct?
Or Moody's does.
Yeah. And those are the three ways listed on page 12 of your testimony, correct?
Yes.
And just... May I approach the witness, Your Honor?
You may.
Dr. Gaskey, I've handed you what we've marked as Exhibit PSC 28. Is that the Moody's source that you used in your rebuttal testimony?
Yes.
Okay. You talked about several utilities being downgraded. You would agree with me that MDU, Montana Dakota, was not one of them, correct?
That's correct.
And you heard Ms. Cavisto state that was the case as well, correct?
Yes.
Weren't the companies that were downgraded those with limited cushion in their rating for deterioration in financial performance?
Yes.
And didn't Moody's also say the vast majority, or excuse, I should offer PSC 28 at this time.
Any objections?
No objection.
Mr. Jeff Kotsako?
No objection.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Major?
No objection, sir.
Okay. PSC 28 will be received.
And did Moody's also say the vast majority of U.S. regulated utilities will continue to maintain stable rating outlooks?
Yes.
No further questions. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Kaufman.
No questions.
Major.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Gaskey. Do you know what MDO's current ROE is?
I believe Ms. Vista said yesterday that. I should ask you. What they're actually earning or what they're allowed?
What they're allowed.
I believe they're currently allowed 9.5.
And that was part of a settlement agreement in 2015, correct?
That's correct.
And that settlement agreement was approved by the commission?
Yes.
And their business risk at the time, would you agree, is the same as it is today?
Pretty much, yes.
And regulatory risk is about the same?
Yes.
Would you agree that 9.5, or what they're earning currently, is a reasonable ROE?
Well, they're currently actually earning, I believe, 6-something, but the allowed rate of return of 9.5 was a settlement. In general, there are a lot of trade-offs made in a settlement, so... I don't know what else was involved that induced them to accept 9.5.
What the commission approved in that 2015 settlement agreement, the 9.5, would you agree that's reasonable?
I believe I testified in the settlement hearing, and very, very softly I objected to it. I thought it was too low, but I accepted the fact that the company was willing to settle and ostensibly got other considerations in order to accept that number.
Great. That's all I have. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
I just have a couple. I guess I need you to, and perhaps it's buried in your direct testimony, but I'm not finding it again at the moment. I'd like you to point to the basis for the conclusion or recommendation that, you know, because the bond yields are low, then FERC says, oh, the adder is too low. Okay. Where is the support, the analysis, so that I can understand more of that cause and effect? It seems to me if people are flocking to buy utility stocks because the bond yields are too low, it's a condition that you accept it, you know, at face value as opposed to adjusting for it. I'm just showing my ignorance here with economics, but point me to where I need to go so I can get some more information. And perhaps you've got a footnote or something in your testimony.
There's a section in my rebuttal testimony beginning on page 7. And the heading for that section is effective capital market conditions on the DCF model. And I believe it runs probably about 10 pages.
What page did you refer to, Dr. Gaske? Sorry.
Oh, page 27 of my rebuttal testimony.
Oh, I thought you said 7.
Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was lost, too.
Right. It runs from page 27 to page 33.
Okay, and so are you basically, your sources or your support then for this conclusion is, are these reports that are quoted in here and the footnotes?
And yes, and the reasoning that I described throughout.
Okay. And I guess I have the same general 40,000-foot question about the small company environment. I recognize that it is hard to perhaps choose comparable your proxy companies. You're not going to find them, I understand that are exactly like MDU Gas, okay, in the same kind of demographic and the same kind of geographic area and that sort of thing. But it seems to me that an average person, as opposed to an economist who does this for a living, thinks that some of those things may add less risk as opposed to more risk. So I need to get past your conclusions into what you're using as your support or basis for that conclusion that kind of a company sitting in this kind of an environment, that there is to be more risk as opposed to less. I mean, all you have to do is live here a while
right.
to understand that there's not a lot of competition and there's not a lot of choice. And yes, we don't have a lot of variety in our economic base, but it bounces back, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So
right.
I need to know where you're getting that from as opposed to just your recommendation.
Well, it's the result of my analysis of these operations compared to the proxy companies. So the whole context of it has to be relative to those companies. And when I do that comparison, I see some fairly significant differences. They tend to be much more diversified economies, generally much faster growing. They're not subject to a single, just a small handful of industries that frankly could fluctuate. So I don't know if that's helping you, but
send me to a textbook or send me to some other analysis or some cases where what you're describing equals more risk as opposed to less risk, because there are some factors about that I would see as less risky. About the demographics and the environment of where MDU Gas operates.
Right. The closest thing that I could probably point you to, and I'm not sure I have it quoted in my testimony, is speaking of MDU in particular, Standard & Poor's has written some credit reviews of MDU resources, and in recent years, they from time to time will say that the diversity of the operations under the MDU resources umbrella makes the parent company less risky than any of its subsidiaries individually, that they provide diversification. As far as an analysis of the North Dakota operations, I'm not aware of anybody other than myself who, there isn't a publicly published source that does that kind of analysis. I have to do it.
Okay. How about just for the simple standards that these particular attributes, if your company has this attribute or that attribute, it is more risky?
I'd probably take you back to the Moody's slide, but the Moody's slide is also in my from Moody's is in my testimony about the characteristics that they look for in terms of size and diversity.
Okay.
And then there's a very large economic literature on the fact that small size does indicate or require higher rates of return.
But is that, if other factors are held the same, if all other factors are equal, the size may matter as opposed to other factors?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And where do I go in your testimony? Again, I apologize if I have simply not remembered where to go, to talk about the regulatory environment and the impact of the regulatory environment on this level of risk. It seems we have a tradition in North Dakota of a very favorable regulatory environment mitigating some of these other negatives.
You do. And it's rated somewhat above average. In my direct testimony, I address regulatory risk on beginning on page 34.
And your conclusion on regulatory risk is? I'm not going to reread it right now.
It has slightly below average regulatory risk compared with the proxy companies.
And with this request for the SIP rider, would that not increase the positive regulatory or lack of regulatory risk?
maybe indirectly, but overall, the SIP rider shouldn't have much effect on risk. The reason being that the company can simply file a rate case every single year so that we can all go through this together every year. or it can have a limited rate adjustment to reflect the SIP. So I don't think SIP is really a rate issue. I'm sorry, it's not really a risk issue. It's a regulatory administration issue.
So is it your position that riders in general do not reduce regulatory risk for utilities?
To the extent they reduce regulatory lag, they can reduce risk, but in this particular case, the company files a projected test year. So the projected test year has already taken away the regulatory lag.
So that would sort of mitigate SIP being a reason to reduce regulatory lag. I know that's not the issue you were hired to testify
right.
on.
But. From a risk standpoint, I think the company will recover its costs of this equipment. These major investments that it's making, either with a projected test year and a full-blown rate case, or a SIP with a more limited review. But from an investor standpoint, I think, given the overall structure of the regulatory process here, they would expect that the company can recover the cost.
Okay, I appreciate that. That's all I have. Oh, excuse me. Sorry. I should introduce Pat Fawn, who is with me at the table, which I yesterday was Jerry, today is Pat Fawn. But anyway, he does have a question. Doesn't the cumulative effect of the riders and the future test year, go to mitigate risk further than your analysis might indicate?
Well, the company has a variety of riders already in place, but I just don't see that the SIP will mitigate risk any further. It essentially... I don't see that the company is going to be unable to recover the cost of these investments or even suffer regulatory lag if it wants to file a rate case every year.
That's what we were asking, though, the cumulative effect then of both of those things, that they have a future test year and they won't have lag there, they are asking for a rider and they won't have lag there, does that not further reduce their regulatory risk for purposes of their return?
One or the other of those, but not both. Once you have one, you don't get much in the way of reduced risk by adding the second one. So from a risk standpoint, the future test year and the ability to file every year means that the company should recover its costs of investment. To my mind, the thing that recommends the SIP is you can have a smaller, less involved, less costly rate case or rate adjustment on a regular basis rather than to go through a very lengthy, expensive process every year, such as this one.
So why does the company have, in your opinion, without me having to go over there and read it, why does the company have a slightly less than average regulatory risk?
I think a couple of things that regulatory research associates cite to are The allowed rates of return tend to be consistent with essentially what is typical elsewhere. They're not unusually low. It does have things like the future test year. And in the case of MDU, it has a straight fixed variable rate design. That more or less mitigates the variability of its earnings.
And what are some things a company could have to have a larger, not more than slight, reduced risk? What are other things, regulatory things out there that...
That's a good question, because I look at the ratings and I look at some of the other states that have higher ratings, and I don't see that they necessarily have a whole lot that's different. So, I just don't know. Possibly higher allowed rates of return.
Okay. That's all I have. Thanks,
Judge. I neglected to pass out the exhibit to the commissioners. Could I give that to them in case they want it?
Yes, you can do that now. Yes, thank you. That's PSC 28. Okay, questions from the commissioners. Commissioner Crocius.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to start on I was shuffling and now I... On exhibit, or page number 7 of your slides, the size versus proxy companies of MDU North Dakota Gas.
Was that the one?
Yes. Can you, the others listed, is that just simply for their gas operations if they have other...
That's their entire operation. Unfortunately... if you calculate a dividend yield, you have a publicly traded stock price that encompasses the entire operation. So some of those companies are pure natural gas, and others have other operations, but they had to have at least 65% of the operation natural gas distribution.
So it would be really hard to use that as a comparison anyway.
That's one of the factors you have to consider.
It would be page 11 and 12 of the slides as well. Let me ask this first. If I repeat this correctly, the value line projections, you rely on those? You find them to be accurate?
Well,
credible?
Yes. They're widely used by investors and relied on by investors. They're one of the most widely used sources of this kind of information.
So if the Atmos case in Kentucky is not settled currently and they are seeking an allowed return on equity of 9.7%, but then you see Value Line at 11.5%.
Right. The value line is what they think the companies will actually earn, and the Atmos has other operations besides the Kentucky operation. In some cases, I think Value Line expects certain utilities will have an opportunity to earn more than their allowed rate of return, and they expect that. I think is reflected in their projections.
So hopefully Kentucky regulators won't see this before they make their ruling.
Well, they did make their ruling and came in at 9.7. But
I thought you had said earlier that none of those were settled.
Oh, yes. These were not settled. These were the actual, the commission made the decision. It was litigated, fought out among the parties,
okay.
This is what commission set them.
All right. So you had talked quite a bit about yesterday we heard testimony about the downturn, the slowdown in the oil-related slowdown in Western North Dakota having a negative impact on the business. But can you just, when you did your analysis, were you basing that on a reduction in terms of volume or a reduction in meters? The meters haven't been taken out for all intensive purposes.
I would be most concerned about number of meters, and it's essentially a long-term kind of risk that investors look at as a possibility. It tends to be somewhat high in areas that depend on a single industry, particularly a boom and bust industry like the oil industry. It's not inconceivable that the bottom would fall out of the oil market, and you'd have a lot of the population that moved here suddenly the last few years moving away, and then you'd have meters with no customers.
I think the wording stated slower growth, which doesn't necessarily mean reduced demand. Slower growth just means we're not seeing maybe double-digit growth, but maybe it's 2% growth or 4% growth. It doesn't mean a decline, correct?
Well, a major bust like that probably would see a decline. I know that until the recent oil boom for, I want to say, probably about 7 decades, North Dakota had actually experienced declining population. So the idea that a major oil bust could reverse what's happened in the last 10 years is not inconceivable.
So is it fair to say that the lower oil prices definitely had a negative impact?
That's correct.
So now that oil prices have moved back up, it could have a positive impact. Would that be fair?
Well, for the company, it means that if more people move in, the company will have to invest more and build more mains and services, things like that. So it would have a positive impact. But the risk is what happens over 30 or 40 years, because with a gas distribution utility, you put fixed investments in place for 30 or 40 years. If the market goes bad here, it's not really economical to dig them up and take them to some other state. They're stuck. These are fixed sunk assets. And so you kind of roll the dice with the economy that you're serving.
Now, you had stated that higher interest rates will make utilities less attractive, less competitive with other fixed income investment opportunities, correct?
Yes.
But aren't utility stocks also viewed as a safe haven from volatility in the market?
Generally speaking, yes. Yeah. So, which is why the rate of return tends to be lower for utilities than for a lot of other companies.
Do you think because of the smaller part of MDU in terms of the gas division that investors, I would have to think, are looking at MDU stock overall? They're not just looking at that one component. How do you think they weight it compared to a pure play gas company that's publicly traded?
Probably that. Well, I know that S&P indicates that they consider it to be less risky. That the diversity of its operations means that it has lower risk than the individual operations.
Right. And the reason I'm asking these questions, I'm just trying to weight the testimony in terms of yes, but how do you appropriately weight it, because it's mixed in with under a larger entity.
Right.
Which is good from a diversification standpoint. And then the other part, too, is, and not necessarily directly from your testimony, but there are instances where, the overall, our comparisons to other utilities are made, other industries are made, and then sometimes it's made in a good way, sometimes it's made in the bad way, and it's kind of crisscrossing back and forth. And that's smart. It's how you make a case. But did you cite? And I was looking for it, and now I can't track it down. Did you cite Fitch in your?
I think I did with regard to the effect of the Tax Act.
Right, and I think
in my
rebuttal
testimony.
Right. Okay, correct. You had from the short and medium term, but when I've looked at the actual, the brief from Fitch on impact of the TCJA, I'm just finding out that it's just stating over the short term, and that over the long term, that it's negligible at best. So, but that medium term to me is very important, because you got short term, medium term, long term. I can't find where it states medium term. I just see short term.
And I don't know. I don't. If I understand what you're talking about, the focus of Fitch was largely on both the tax coverage ratios, the fact that when you have a return on equity, say it's 10%, you have to gross that up for taxes, and the tax provides part of the cash that provides coverage and guarantee to the debt holders. The other thing that is short to medium term is the results of excess accumulated deferred income taxes, which that's something once the companies go through the process of more or less refunding that to customers. Then that won't be an issue anymore once they get through that period.
Okay, and then finally, the Q1 earnings for 2018 versus 2017 were 22 versus 19 cents, and I do recognize that the electric side was up, I believe, 3%, and the gas side was down 1%. Based on your analysis, do you think that gas will be slightly down in terms of profits going forward in 2018?
The MDU resources.
Or earnings, I should say.
I haven't done that analysis. I don't know.
Okay. All right. No other questions for me.
Chairman Chrisman.
Good. Just want to make sure I understand a couple of your slides.
Sure.
Contemplating here in the days ahead. On the results of cost of equity studies, did I understand right that you felt the DCF analysis kind of tends to be to show us too low because of Fed policies, correct?
At this time, yes.
But you expect those policies are so why should they be higher now, because of the Fed policies of the last year or 2 years where they've edged interest rates up, or are you basing it on your expectations of future Fed policies?
Now, what's been happening for about the last 8 to 10 years is still kind of an overhang in the market. The Federal Reserve more or less, I guess you could call it printing money, but they bought a lot of Treasury bonds, and essentially they bought about $4 trillion worth of Treasury bonds, and that $4 trillion is still sitting there in the market, driving interest rates down. Their increase in interest rates has been on the federal funds rate, which is the interest rate that banks pay for short-term loans from the Fed. So far you haven't seen a major increase in the longer-term bond rates. A lot of people expect them to start going up, but they haven't done so yet.
And that's what your testimony is based on, is your expectations that they're going to go up.
This part of the testimony is based on the fact that the market is currently depressed. Yeah.
Not a fact that's out there that it's going to change in the next year or 2 or 3 years. It's just your expectation.
And the forecast of various forecasting groups that publish these forecasts. I have data in there from Blue Chip Economic Indicators, and what they do is they survey it's about 20 or 30 different major forecasting houses, the banks and economic forecasting companies that publish forecasts, and their overall expectation is for a fairly dramatic increase in bond yields.
And you find those forecasts reliable?
Almost all economic forecasts are. They rarely turn out to be correct in hindsight, but people make their decisions based on those forecasts, and they can come in too high or too low.
Then the gas utility risk premiums slide?
Yes.
What years does this encompass?
1992 to, I think, 2016 or 17.
And is this all of the cases that happened in those 25 years? Or is this selected ones? Or I don't know what I'm seeing here.
That's all of the cases that Regulatory Research Associates they try to capture everybody, but that's all of the cases that had a stated rate of return in the decision. A lot of decisions have black box settlements and don't have a stated rate of return,
but of the these are the stated. It's not a selected group. It's all the ones that were available.
Yes, it's all of them.
Okay, and you said this morning that the of cities that MDU Gas serves, Bismarck is by far the largest, right?
And that's correct.
Are you familiar with Bismarck's growth rate in recent years as opposed to maybe national averages?
I know it's been extremely rapid.
Okay, and were you here yesterday for the testimony when we heard about selling a couple of office buildings and other, by this service territory standards, more mid-sized communities at big profits, or at least at profits? Mm-hmm. Because they needed newer, bigger office buildings in those towns?
Yes.
And did you hear the testimony about needing to buy modular homes because the new employees they needed to hire couldn't find housing
Yes.
in those towns? And so on slide 6, the relative risk factors, are you saying that MDU Gas has had slower customer growth than comparable companies you looked at? It seems to me that would be pretty fast growth.
Well, at the time I did the testimony, it had it had leveled out quite a bit, but by and large, it was very rapid for a few years. Then it leveled out, and we'll see if it comes back.
But do you usually base these things on like a 12-month period or 24-month period, or more a sliding scale where you'd encompass 5 or 10 years or some longer period?
For measuring financial market conditions, I do it on probably about a 6-month period and what they currently are. For measuring risk, for an operation where when you put an investment in the ground, it's you don't get to recover it totally for about 30 or 40 years. So when I look at risk, I look at long term. The risk assessment has to be for a long term.
Okay. You used the term a couple times, the oil busts.
Mm-hmm.
The slowdown in oil and gas activity in North Dakota in the last few years, would you characterize that as an oil bust, as we've usually used the term in relation to, say, oil bust in the 80s or something like that?
Well, I think it was relatively moderate compared to the 80s, but part of my thinking on that is I actually saw it. I moved to Texas in the mid 80s, and an area that had been rapidly growing, been growing for 15% a year, and when we moved there, we couldn't understand why every fifth house was empty. And then people explained that they lost their job, their mortgage was underwater, and they walked away. And so I've seen it happen. It can happen, and investors are aware that it can happen.
So that was in the 80s, but do you consider what happened in North Dakota in the last few years a real oil bust? And I guess the second part of the question, do you think that the oil and gas industry of the 21st century is still as vulnerable to boom and bust cycles as the oil and gas industry of the 20th century?
Absolutely. Like it or not, the oil industry in North Dakota is basically at the whim of Saudi Arabia and OPEC countries, and whether they decide to be tight or you know, open the spigots and pump all out.
You said when I asked you about the cost of equity studies that you rely a lot on, or that you rely somewhat on forecasters. Have you looked at the North Dakota Oil and Gas Division forecasts for oil and gas activity for the next 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 years?
No.
Okay. Then on slides 11 and 12, I just want to ask another question or two on what Commissioner Crashus had asked about. The value line projected ROE for 11.5% that was in decided at 9.7. Did I understand you correctly that the value line projection contemplates other activities outside of the regulated activity?
Possibly, but Atmos is mostly a large natural gas distribution holding company. So the 9.7 we saw was their Kentucky jurisdiction, but I think they're in at least a dozen different states.
Similar to my question on that busier chart, are the Are the seven companies that that you list as having decision results in the first 5 months of this year, is that all of the decisions that are available for this year, or are these some that you selected?
No, this is all of the decisions this year in which it was a litigated case. I had somebody in my office download it last week. So,
and then the seven companies that you chose in the value line projected ROEs, did they just do those companies, or did you choose those out of many?
They had about 10 or 11 companies, and I eliminated, I think I eliminated one because it got less than 65% of its business from natural gas distribution. I think I eliminated another one because it was involved in a merger at the time.
So tell me why I should put much weight into at least slide 12 here, since Value Line was looking at other things than the regulated part. And we are only dealing with the regulated part of MDU.
If you take the first one, I think Atmos is almost all natural gas distribution. I mean, it's almost all regulated.
Value Line projected at 11.5 and came in at 9.7, and so that tells me Value Line isn't probably a very good indicator for me to base a decision on.
Well, I think Value Line is expecting that some of those companies will earn more than their allowed rate of return. The 9.7 was for their Kentucky jurisdiction, but that's relatively small compared to the rest of their business. So there are a variety of things that they take into consideration. Some of them may be allowed rates of return that have been in place for a long time without rate cases.
No other questions, thank you.
Okay.
Commissioner Fedorchik.
Thank you. So I have some of the similar lines of questions, but a couple others that we haven't talked about yet. So it took in my observation, it took a fair amount of time for the allowed ROEs to adjust down when interest rates were falling. And in fact, we still have a company, a regulated utility, who has an interest rate set way back when pretty high, or an ROE
right,
that still hasn't been adjusted. So why should we be so quickly, even before the interest rates are going up, be adjusting these back up?
Well, the returns in my study are mostly based on what we have currently. In some cases, it's forecasts, but I think the one place where I use an interest rate forecast, I give it about one-third weight with what the current ones are, and that was just projected out for about 18 months. For the most part, these are all based on current market conditions, the numbers that are on the my results tab.
I'm interested too in the risk factors, the relative risk factors on chart number 6. You have are these how are they weighted? Are they pretty much equally weighted, or in your
no? Business risk is by far the most important.
Based on who? Whose opinion? Because I've read from Moody's and others that perhaps regulatory risk is the most important. So who says that business risk is the most important?
I think that's widely accepted as in investment analysis. For utilities, the regulatory risk is very important, but so is the business risk. The financial risk is interesting because it doesn't stand by itself. What it does is if you borrow and you have leverage, you take on a lot of debt, what you're really doing is magnifying the business risk. So it's business risk is crucial to financial risk.
Okay. So if you were to weight these, how would you do that?
Hadn't really thought of it in those terms, but you know, I would say business risk is probably 60%. Financial risk, which I said it's very hard to separate that from business risk because it mostly just multiplies business risk. Maybe 20% and regulatory risk 20%.
Okay. Even for utilities. You
yes.
acknowledge that for utilities the regulatory risk is higher.
When I'm doing my comparison between utilities, one utility against another, business risk is more important. It is important.
So business risk, even with utilities compared to each other, trumps the regulatory risk. So it seems like it would be the opposite. If they're both facing regulatory risk, the regulatory factors would be more important in those cases.
Both of them are very important.
So 50-50.
I'm reluctant to give it a percentage number, but because it depends on circumstances.
Here's where I'm going, and I think you've heard this from some of the others too. What you're asking here, or what you're basically, your conclusion is, your analysis comes out with a 9.5% ROE, but you're saying that MDU utilities should get 10% just because they're a risky business.
Or riskier than those proxy companies, yes.
Okay. And the other risk factors, which they fare well on, aren't given much consideration.
They are given consideration, but the most important one is the business risk.
Okay. In your opinion?
And the others, they're close to the average.
And we're all comparing to the proxy companies?
Yes.
Okay. So then I want to talk more about the proxy company selection. Let's see here. In your testimony, you, on page 17, kind of went through how you selected the proxy companies, and you did that today as well. You eliminated those that didn't have investment grade. You eliminated those that don't pay dividends. You eliminated those that don't have a future growth rate estimates provided by some agencies, those that are going through mergers, acquisitions, et cetera, and those that didn't derive at least 65% of their operating income from regulated natural gas distribution operations, et cetera. But yet you told Commissioner Crosius that these companies here, you didn't just consider their utility. You did for MDU natural gas, but the rest of them, you included their parent company as well. Is that fair then? How can that's not an apples to apples comparison?
Well, that's part of the reason I have to do that risk analysis or risk adjustment. The parent company has the publicly traded common stock that we use to calculate a dividend yield and a growth rate or a beta for the capital asset pricing model.
Which include risk.
Right. And so...
So that dividend and those other calculations, the risk of that company is included in those factors,
right.
Correct?
Yes. And you didn't include
that with MDU.
For the most part, these companies are very highly concentrated in natural gas distribution, either all or the vast majority of it. So you don't have a lot of diversity of types of businesses. You have some in some of the companies, but
which would that make them more or less risky? Based on your analysis in the Moody's chart,
it could go either way. Sometimes diversity reduces the risk of the parent company. That's what S&P says about MDU Resources. Sometimes, if it's the other operation is a very risky operation, it would increase the risk. I don't think that's much of an issue with these particular companies.
Based on your chart number 9, it says that economic diversity is one of the things that Moody's looks at to assess risk. So then MDU Utilities' participation in MDU Resources should make it less risky. So
it makes MDU Resources less risky, but it doesn't make the North Dakota operation less risky per se. Those operations kind of stand on their own. One example I like to use is if MDU were to spin those off, I don't think the cost of capital or allowed rate of return would change. Or if MDU were to sell those operations to an extremely risky company, I don't think the risk of the natural gas distribution operations here would change based on who owns it. It's based on what the nature of its service territory is and the economy and the climate and the investment risk of those assets.
I'm having trouble embracing the need to assess them a higher ROE for based on risk because of their comparison to these proxy companies, which to me isn't being presented in a way that is really fair, because you're including the assets and the income of the proxy companies as part of their parent companies, and you're not for the utility, for MDU.
Right, and that's solely because there's not a publicly traded stock in the natural gas distribution operations in North Dakota. If that traded publicly, then it would be a much easier comparison. Unfortunately, the companies that we have the data on to do these analyses are large of necessity are publicly traded.
Or you could have just included them as part of the MD Resources for the purpose of those two charts.
Well, the risks of the North Dakota operations are pretty much on a standalone basis.
The risks, but the assets and the income as it relates to these other companies would have been more fairly represented in an apples-to-apples comparison if you had included them as part of the parent company.
Well, typically in regulation, you have to look at a company on a standalone basis, regardless of what other operations it has. The risks of North Dakota exist on a standalone basis. Probably the best example of that would be that we heard how the North Dakota operations benefit through sharing of resources with the parent company, that you've got eight or nine companies that all share Nicole's salary. So that you get efficiencies, but they're not sharing the risks. If Cascade Natural Gas, one of their subsidiaries, if they have an earthquake that destroys their distribution system, they cannot come to you and say, you know, we also provide service in North Dakota. We want to recover our Cascade Natural Gas costs from ratepayers in North Dakota. You wouldn't allow it. If you have a major oil bust, an Air Force base closes, and they're having trouble recovering the costs in North Dakota, the cost of the distribution system in North Dakota, I can assure you that the Washington Commission is not going to add that on to the rates of the Cascade ratepayers. So you have to look at the risks on a standalone basis.
On your chart of the on page 11, two of those are included in your proxy group, but several of them aren't. Like the Liberty and Liberty Utilities in New Hampshire, and the other Missouri. Those seem like they might be smaller. How come you didn't include those? Are they?
Each of those is Liberty is not covered by Value Line, and so I didn't have the same kind of forecast data on them. And that's true of all the ones on there that are not on there. If you look at Spire, Missouri, and Missouri Gas Energy down at the bottom. Both of those are subsidiaries of Spire, but Spire owns gas district, and that's one of my proxy companies, but they also own Alabama Gas Company, so they have other operations. Mm-hmm. These are commission rate case decisions, just like this one, where if you reach a decision, Regulatory Research Associates would publish that decision as North Dakota Gas rather than the entire MDU resources.
Okay. Let's see. So then my final question, the ROE is, how important is that for attracting capital? What other factors do they look at besides the allowed ROE?
Whether or not it's likely that they can achieve it.
Okay. So those two factors.
Right. And, you know, so if it's inadequate or if it's a great allowed ROE, but it's unlikely they can achieve it, they won't be able to attract capital.
And in your are you aware of MDU having had trouble attracting capital?
No.
And are they paying higher interest rates or any sort of a penalty at all for not having a high enough ROE currently that you're aware of, or has that been a problem in the past?
I'm not aware that it's been a problem, no.
Okay. And so help me also understand the difference between 10 and 9.5 as it relates to an investment perspective.
Essentially, investors decide where to put their money, and if they can get 10% elsewhere, they will put the money elsewhere. I think in MDU's case, they've got a large holding company. They have to decide, you know, where they put internal funds, where they put it in North Dakota, or they put it in some other operation, or buy some other company. So they have to constantly weigh these kinds of decisions.
Okay, that's it for me. Thanks.
Mr. Sanderson, redirect.
Yeah, Judge, before we do this, our court reporter's been going for 2 hours. Can we just take a short break?
Okay, we can take I want to finish up with Mr. Rubin before we break for lunch today. So let's try to be back in 10 minutes at 10:35. Okay, we'll go back on the record. I just wanted to point out on the record that Mr. Rubin's flight leaves at 1, and so I want to really wrap up with him by noon, so if we can expedite finishing up with Mr. Garski. Mr. Garski, you going to leave today, or is he going to be around for a while yet?
He'll be around.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you. Dr. Gaskey, I'd like to just start on this issue. There's some concern or confusion regarding the proxy companies that were selected. First off, why these proxy companies that you selected? What's the driving factor for the selection?
These are the companies that have the publicly available stock prices and forecasts that we need to do the analysis.
Okay. And selection of proxy companies is something that's done in every analysis similar to this, correct?
That's correct.
And advocacy staff's expert, Mr. Griffin, selected the same proxy companies, correct?
Had one additional one because Value Line started covering it after my testimony was filed.
And FEA's expert, Mr. Gorman, selected these exact same proxy companies for the same reason you did, correct?
He had a few different. Left at least one out because it was involved in a merger by the time he did his analysis.
In a merger.
So, yes, it's the same proxy company.
But just to be clear, these are not companies you cherry-picked to support an ROE. These are the ones that had natural gas companies that had publicly available data.
This is a very standard process of selecting proxy companies.
Okay. I want to get into the issue of the comparison of MDU Natural Gas Utility, Montana, Dakota, versus using the MDU resources as a whole. You're certainly aware that under the MDU resources umbrella, there's a big part of it is Knife River Construction, Construction Services, Inc., and WBI Energy that are not regulated utilities.
That's correct.
Okay. And in fact, MDU Resources, its entire umbrella, only 58% of it the assets would be related to utilities. That's your understanding?
Yes.
Okay. But when we look at these other proxy companies that you've identified, they're even the ones with umbrella holdings are still utility companies.
A couple of them have some diversified operations, but those tend to be very small. They're either pure utilities or tiny diversified operations for the most part.
Could you just put your slide up with this bar graph?
Oops.
Okay. And the team, as you're aware, was working on this, but if under MDU Resources Group, if we just pulled out the utility portion of that, it roughly the utilities would amount to 3.7 to 3.9 total assets in the millions, which would be right in line with Northwest Natural Gas, New Jersey Resources, and South Jersey, but still on the very small end of the proxy companies.
Yes, but that's not what we're here to set a rate of return for.
Certainly. So I'm just the point of, so if we break MDU Resources umbrella down to the various utility companies, including electricity and the gas, we'd be more in line at the small. Now let's get into why that is not a fair comparison. And could you just explain the Washington analogy you made with Cascade?
Well, each of the operations has to stand alone based on its own risks. The standalone principle is actually a very common principle in regulation and rate making, that no matter what kinds of affiliates, whether they're riskier or less risky, you try to ignore that in setting the rate of return for the company that that you're regulating and setting the rate for. The Cascade example that you ask about, I'll just repeat what I said before, which is that if something happens to the North Dakota gas operations, it's nice that they own Cascade, MDU Resources does, but the investment in North Dakota will not be recovered from the Cascade operations. So these operations, from a risk standpoint, stand on their own.
Okay. Now, to Commissioner Fedorchuk's questions of, you know, why from a 9.5 ROE does the risk factor go up? And a couple of the things you pointed out on that affect the risk factors were size, lack of diversity, lack of growth. And to the point of counsel's question, staff counsel's question, and the commissioner's question on that, I'd ask you to turn to page 17 of your rebuttal testimony.
I'm there.
Okay, and Dr. Gaske, you were asked, can you give citations to sources that support this risk appropriate? And in the footnotes there, footnotes 16, 17, and 18, you cite those, but specifically the Annan equity and the small stock effect from 1995. Could you just explain how that impacts, size impacts the risk analysis?
Well, all of those sources are examples of studies that go to this size and risk question. It's supported by a very large literature in the financial economics, but the Annan article that you point to is one that was specific to public utilities and found that there was a strong, statistically significant difference in the rate of return required by utilities based on their size. Smaller ones required a higher rate of return.
And let's talk about the risk impact of that small size. And you use the example of the Minot Air Force Base, but the six biggest gas customers from Montana, Dakota, if the Tesoro refinery was shut down for some reason, or the Bobcat plant that you provide gas to in Gwinner, what effect due to size would that have on Montana, Dakota's natural gas service and rates?
Well, it would be detrimental, obviously, and there are a lot of factors involved. But typically for a utility, if you have a few really large major customers that shut down, you lose that business and the costs have to be recovered elsewhere. But probably from a risk standpoint, as important is the effect on the local economy. The people who work there lose their jobs. the places they shop lose business, and can have a very negative effect.
And certainly with that question, certainly does not mean anything to our wonderful friends and customers at Tesoro or the Bobcat or the Air Force Base. So it certainly could have that impact. But let's talk about this growth. And Commissioner Christian or Chrisman asked you some questions on growth. And there was some growth in the Bakken. But let's talk about the growth of the system. Are you aware, Dr. Gaskey, that the last time Montana Dakota expanded to a new community with gas service was in the 1970s?
That's my understanding, yes.
So when we're talking about risk factor and growth, I mean, yes, there's some community sprawl that's occurred in Bismarck and some other communities. But as compared to the utility industry, nationwide, we're not seeing the growth into new customer markets or new communities. Is that fair?
I'd say that's reasonable.
And so when you're talking about risk to Montana Dakota's North Dakota operations with respect to growth, that would be what you're referring to.
Well, I guess it's not a simple yes or no.
Yeah, I mean,
it's more complicated than that. How robust is the business?
And I didn't mean to certainly implicate that that's the only consideration into growth. But just in conclusion, Dr. Gaskey, and in light of all these questions, it's still your position that based on the analysis and the risk factors posed by Montana Dakota's North Dakota gas operation, that the risk factors call for an increase in the ROE to, in your opinion, 10%?
Well, more than what's indicated by the DCF analysis, but essentially what is indicated by the gas utility risk premium analysis, which was 10%. So, and in that analysis, I don't have any adjustment for size. I just note that the relative to the DCF results, the median for the DCF results is lower than what I believe is the cost of capital for the Montana Dakota, North Dakota operations.
Thank you, Dr. Gaskey. I have no further questions.
Mr. Armstrong.
Two quick questions, Dr. Gaskey. Commissioner Chrisman was asking you about the slide on page 12 of your slides, the value line slide.
Yes.
Are those projected ROEs based on book value or market value?
Book value.
And is a given dollar value return higher when expressed as a percentage of market value or book value?
It can depend on whether market value is above or below book value.
Isn't book value typically higher?
No, the other way around.
You haven't done anything to compare book or market value for that slide, have you?
I'm aware of it for those companies, it's the market value is higher than book value.
Thank you. Those questions I have,
Mr. Kaufman.
Yes, two clarifying questions. And based on your slide 11, where you show recent commission-determined ROEs, first, on the two utilities you list for my home state of Missouri there, are those not the two utilities that are merged now?
Yeah, they're separate. Oh, and they're separate subsidiaries of Spire.
Or aren't they operating divisions of the same utility now?
Yes. The decisions, though, were to set the rates for them separately.
But wasn't that the very same order? They set the same ROE for both there on February 21st?
I haven't read the order. This was
one order, right?
This was reported by regulatory research associates. And but I guess it was two rate-making cases.
If, in fact, it's now one utility and you're double counting it here, the highest number, isn't that unfair?
Slanting
your number higher?
I don't know if the rates were set separately for the two companies. Certainly, RRA lists them as a separate set of rates. If they have a combined single tariff now that they no longer have separate tariffs and sets of rates, then you would be correct.
Although you make an adjustment based on size, aren't there a couple of utilities here that are smaller than MDU? MDU is not smaller than all these utilities, are they?
The North Dakota operations, that I can't tell you. I haven't analyzed size for these allowed rates of return.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
Major Unsicker.
No, sir.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
Nothing. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Gaskey. I think you can step down. Mr. Rubin, if you want to step up.
Yes. I want to thank you for the accommodation to get Mr. Rubin on the stand.
Welcome.
So we call Scott Rubin, and we will be offering exhibits AARP 43 and AARP 44. I mean, I could do that now, or if you want me to lay a foundation, I can. It's his PowerPoint slides and the Nasuka resolution, which have been distributed to.
No objection.
Mr. Armstrong?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No objections.
Major?
No objections.
Okay, AARP 43 and 44 will be received. And please spell your name, Mr. Is it two T's and Scott?
Yes, it's Scott Rubin.
Okay, raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding.
Yes, I do.
Thank you. Mr. Kaufman.
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Rubin, are you the same Scott Rubin that prepared direct and surrebuttal testimony in this matter and has been already admitted in the record as AARP 41 and AARP 42, respectively?
Yes.
Do you have any minor corrections you need to make to those testimonies?
Yes. There are just a couple of minor corrections in the direct testimony, page 31. On both lines 8 and 9, I'm not sure what I was thinking, but the abbreviation is wrong. Instead of CPH, it should be CFH, cubic feet per hour. On page 32 of the direct testimony, line 3, the third from the last word, which is reduce, should be increase. The way it reads now just makes no sense. And in the surrebuttal testimony, AARP 42, page 2, line 2, where I have 12-IN, the IN should be inch. And those are all the changes I have.
Okay. With those corrections, would your answers in Exhibit AARP 41 and 42 be the same today?
Yes, they would.
Could you begin with briefly explaining your education and background?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I earned my bachelor's degree from Penn State University, my law degree from George Washington University. For the past 35 years, my professional life has been devoted to trying to make the public utility industries more responsive to the needs of consumers. I began that work with the Pennsylvania Office of Consumer Advocate. After about 10 years in government service, I started my own practice where I serve a wide range of clients, including public advocates, utility labor unions, citizens groups, government-owned utilities, small businesses, and government agencies. Over the years, I have testified before two congressional committees and as an expert witness in more than 175 utility commission and court cases in about 20 U.S. states and one Canadian province. AARP is one of my newer clients. They retained me just a little over a year ago to provide advice, analysis, and expert testimony throughout the country on important utility-related issues of concern to its members.
Mr. Rubin, do you have a brief opening statement to summarize your testimony?
Yes, and we have some slides to go with that, which I guess were just marked as AARP 43.
Please proceed.
We'll see if I can do this. Okay, I hit the right button, which is always good. I'm pleased that AARP asked me to testify in this case because it raises four important and timely issues. First, as in every rate case, you must determine how to allocate any revenue increase among the customer classes. Fortunately, all of the parties agree on the class revenue allocation in this case, though we may not agree on how we all reached that conclusion. MDU proposed that the residential class should be responsible for paying 58.9% of any revenue increase, and the firm general service class would pay the remaining 41.1% of any revenue increase. The other customer classes, including the Air Force, other large users, and interruptible customers, would not see their rates change at all. I accepted MDU's recommendation in my direct testimony. The Air Force's expert witness, Mr. Gorman, reached the same conclusion in his direct testimony. And as I understand it, staff's expert, Mr. Pavlovic, also recommended no change in rates for any customer classes other than rates 60 and 70. So on this first issue, the parties have made your life easy. We agree with the company's proposal, even though we don't necessarily agree on how we reached that conclusion. The second important issue I discuss is the design of rates for residential customers. MDU's cost of service study shows that about 75% of all residential costs are customer-related. I disagreed with that analysis and found that the correct number would be between about 63% and 72%. Nevertheless, all of the studies agree that no more than 75% of residential costs are customer-related. Yet MDU has proposed that 100% of its residential distribution revenues should be collected through the customer charge. There is no support for such a result. The company's study, as well as my revisions to the study, all show that at least one quarter of residential costs are related to customers' demand for and use of natural gas. MDU's actual billing data demonstrate the fallacy of the company's contention that each residential customer should pay the same amount toward system demand. On pages 29 and 30 of my direct testimony, which we've highlighted here, I show that the largest residential customers use more gas in 10 hours than the smallest residential customers use during the entire peak month of January. It is absolutely impossible to conclude that each residential customer contributes the same amount to peak demand as each other residential customer. Now, I also recognize that moving to a strictly cost-based residential rate design would reduce the customer charge from its current level and impose a significant per-therm usage charge. That change could have a significant effect on larger residential customers, especially during the winter. For that reason, I have recommended no change in the residential customer charge. so that any increase in residential revenues would be collected through a per-therm charge. That would keep the customer charge above cost, but it would at least start moving toward rates that accurately reflect the cost of serving residential customers' demand for gas. Now, third, I have raised a significant concern about the company's proposal to adopt a separate rate adjustment mechanism for safety and integrity programs. Let me be absolutely clear about one thing. The most important responsibility of a gas utility is to ensure that the system is safe. In recent years, we have seen in all too many places, from San Bruno, California to Allentown, Pennsylvania, the devastation that results when a utility neglects this fundamental responsibility. And I use that word neglect intentionally. Both of those disasters resulted from utility negligence. I followed the Allentown disaster in 2011 very closely, not just because I'm a utility geek, like so many of us in the room, but because I live about an hour and a half from Allentown, I live in a 50-year-old house, and I'm served by the same gas utility. The Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission found that the utility failed to comply with existing regulations and safety standards in several critical respects, including monitoring odorant levels, promptly responding to leak complaints, and even conducting basic inspection and maintenance that would have caused any reasonable utility to investigate subsurface disturbances. As a result, the utility was fined $500,000, which was the maximum fine the PUC could levy under the law that then existed, and to make numerous operational changes. In San Bruno, California, the utility's negligence was even more blatant. A 30-inch transmission main was not installed and maintained properly. The utility in that case was found to have violated numerous existing safety standards, and the California PUC ordered fines and bill credits totaling in the hundreds of millions of dollars, as well as ordering the utility to make numerous operational changes. A special rate-making mechanism would have done absolutely nothing to prevent the utility's negligence in those disasters. So, too, MDU's proposal for a separate rate mechanism is not needed to ensure the safety and integrity of the system. Let's look at the facts. I know there are a lot of numbers on the slide we put up. This is from MDU's depreciation study. It's Exhibit MDU-1, Schedule EMR-1. It gives us important information about the age of the company's infrastructure. Table 5 of EMR-1, which I've excerpted here, shows that steel and plastic distribution mains have an average service life of between 47 and 62 years. Importantly, the study also tells us that these mains have, on average, a remaining life of between 33 and 42 years. In other words, these are very long-lived assets that, on average, have been in service for only about one-third of their expected life. So while, of course, there are always facilities that need to be replaced, overall, the company's basic infrastructure appears to have been kept up to date without having a special rate mechanism in place. Indeed, we heard Ms. Cavisto testify yesterday that if the SSIP mechanism had been in place in 2015, there would have been no change in the plant investment decisions made by MDU over the last 3 years. Similarly, Mr. Darris testified yesterday that the SSIP operational plan and the special rate-making mechanism are two separate things, and one is not affected by the other. In a rate case like this one, you must look at all aspects of the company's operations, It's capital spending, the cost of raising capital, sales, customer counts, taxes, depreciation, and all other types of expenses. I don't envy the work you have in front of you. From that in-depth examination, you determine the price that customers should pay, because we cannot rely on a competitive market to set that price. You cannot look at just one part of a utility's operations and determine how that should affect the price. Spending on one program may increase, but spending on other programs or computers or dozens of other things might decrease by an offsetting amount. And that's the fundamental problem with the company's proposal. It would change prices based on only one type of change, ignoring all of the other changes that might occur at the same time. The importance of avoiding that type of single-issue rate making was recognized by the National Association of State Utility Consumer Advocates in a 2005 resolution that we have marked as AARP 44. I agree with that resolution, and I recommend that you deny MDU's request for a special rate adjustment mechanism. As important as safety is, there is absolutely no evidence that a special rate adjustment is needed in order for MDU to maintain a safe system. Finally, I have objected to MDU's proposal to increase its return check charge from $15 to $40. There is no support for this change. MDU's own data, which we have up on the screen, shows that the current $15 charge is more than enough to collect the costs it incurs when a customer sends a check or other payment that is dishonored by the bank. MDU's proposal would be punitive, and there is no need to impose a punitive charge to deter a customer from issuing a dishonored payment. Frankly, banks take care of that for us, as I discuss in my testimony. Thank you again for the opportunity to be here today and for taking me out of order. I look forward to answering any questions that you, your staff, and the parties may have for me.
Okay. Mr. Sanderson, cross-examination.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Rubin. My name is Paul Sanderson. I represent Montana Dakota Utilities in this case. I'd like to follow up and ask you some questions, both on the testimony you gave here and also the testimony you filed in this case. But just so we're perfectly clear, you and AARP are in agreement with the revenue allocation that it's reasonable, assigning it to the residential and firm general customers?
Yes.
Okay. Now, one of the critical issues you point out, and more so in your pre-filed testimony, was the distribution system costs, the allocation of system main costs. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Okay. And Montana Dakota, in this case, is proposing 25% of those costs be allocated to customer-related and 75% allocated to demand. You're aware that's a proposal?
Correct.
And they're applying that under the minimum systems method, correct?
Well, no. Montana Dakota Utilities does not have a supporting analysis that shows where that 25% came from. It appears to be a number that was selected without the type of analysis that is typically done in a minimum system study.
Okay. Well, you agree some jurisdictions have adopted a minimum systems analysis.
That is true, but I'm not aware of any that have arbitrarily selected a number like 25%.
And let's disregard what Montana Dakota's 25%. You, in fact, did a minimum systems analysis in this case, correct?
I did the best I could with the information available. A lot of it was not information specific to MDU, which is normally what I would expect to have.
Well, and you used some information and depreciation information from Nicor Gas in Illinois?
Yes.
To form the basis of that? And you found, relying on that, that was a reliable source, using Nicor Gas in Illinois to compare to the MDU system?
I thought it was a reasonable proxy to use given the lack of specific information for MDU.
Okay. And just to not belabor this point, but so you took some information from Nicor Gas, did your own minimum systems method analysis, and you determined the customer cost would be 18.16% instead of the 25% Montana Dakota is proposing.
Correct.
Okay. Now, AARP takes issue with the basic service charge in this case. Am I correct on that point?
Yes, but just to be clear, I'm an independent expert. You can ask my opinion. I don't speak for AARP. They will speak through their attorney, who will file a brief, I assume. So I'm giving you my opinion that AARP has sponsored, and I'd prefer you phrase it that way rather than AARP says.
Well, and I respect you trying to qualify that, Mr. Rubin, but I'm not going to get to ask questions of AARP's attorney. The only person from AARP that I'm going to get to ask questions from in this case that they've identified is going to testify to these commissioners is you. Are you saying you don't support AARP's position in this case?
No, I'm saying that I have set forth my position, which AARP has sponsored.
Okay.
And I fully expect that counsel will support that position in briefs. I just get a little uncomfortable when someone suggests that I'm speaking for AARP. I happen to be a member, but I'm not an officer or spokesperson for the organization. I'm a utility rate-making expert, and that's why I'm here.
Okay. You recognize that this commission adopted a straight fixed variable rate design implementing a flat basic service charge of 64 cents per day in Montana Dakota's last rate case in 2015.
I recognize that's what the commission order says. I frankly don't think that's a straight fixed variable rate design, but we can explore that if we need to.
Well,
but I agree that the commission adopted the recovery of 100% of residential distribution costs through a customer charge.
Okay. And you're aware that is how customers are paying those residential rates today?
Yes.
Okay. And are you sitting here telling this commission that they were wrong when they adopted that rate recovery mechanism in the 2015 case?
The answer is no. I don't know what information the commission had before it at that time. Based on the information available to me in this case, that is not a correct way to set rates for the residential class.
Well, you're certainly aware, Mr. Rubin, that AARP intervened in that 2015 case.
I believe AARP did not have a witness in that case.
Well, you're aware Mr. Kaufman sat right where he's sitting now in 2015 in that case.
I don't know where he sat, but I know he was present somewhere.
Okay. So. And you're aware that the AARP did not appeal the decision setting forth the straight fixed variable rate design that this commission adopted in 2015.
I'm not aware of that one way or the other.
And one of the things you provided in your direct testimony is why this fixed cost is not appropriate is because approximately 1% of the cost to serve residential customers are energy related. Was that your direct testimony?
That is one of the pieces of information I relied on. There's much more to it than that.
Okay. Conversely to that, 99% of the residential cost would be fixed.
I do not agree with that.
Okay. Is that not in your testimony on page 28 and 29?
Well, I discuss demand-related costs extensively in my testimony, and I do not consider demand-related costs to be fixed, as you use the term, unless we're looking at a very short time horizon. Typically in economics and especially in public utility economics, we look at whether a cost is fixed or variable using a fairly long-term horizon. We don't set rates based on, you know, what a variable cost is today. We look at the expected life of facilities and at the turnover of those facilities. So, you know, yes, obviously the mains that are in the ground today are there and that investment is fixed, but that investment is sunk. But in terms of economics, that doesn't make it all a fixed cost. As those facilities need to be replaced, and we've heard a lot yesterday about the need for replacement, the sizing of those facilities will depend very much on expectations about customer demand. And whether you accept the company's approach that says 75% of the cost is demand related, or my approach that says, you know, 100% is demand related, there's no question that customer demand influences the size of those facilities each time a replacement decision has to be made.
And Mr. Rubin, let's get back to how you determined your determination that these are not all fixed costs according to what MDU is asserting in this case. And I want to turn to page 31 of your direct testimony.
Yes, I'm there.
And in your direct testimony, you note that Montana, Dakota has 29 residential customers that would require a larger meter.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, at least 29. It may be more than that.
So at least 29. And therefore, you make the logical conclusion in the next paragraph, since those 29 largest residential customers would need a slightly bigger meter, therefore, not all customer costs to serve the customers is the same.
Well, the way you described it sounds a little silly.
I agree.
It's an example.
Okay.
It's an example of the type of cost that we can very easily demonstrate is demand-related. The reason those 29 or more residential customers have larger and more expensive meters and regulators is because they use a lot of gas. Yeah. If I could finish. And to simply assume that every residential customer is the same and that the demand for gas and the use of gas have no effect on the cost to serve the customers is demonstrably false. This is one easy way to demonstrate it. Those large customers in the residential class require meters that are five times more expensive than the typical meter. That's not the only thing that's required to serve them, but it's an easy example to use to show the problem with ignoring that different customers have different level of demand and that has a real cost consequence to it.
And the analogy you're just using there that you're trying to explain to this commission why they were wrong in 2015, and the logic behind it is because 29 of 94,000 residential customers would require a slightly more expensive meter, so you're saying then the cost to serve the customers is different. That's the leap in logic you're trying to make with 29 out of 94,000 customers.
Objection, I don't hear a question in that.
Yeah, it's argumentative. Sustain.
Let's move, Mr. Rubin, to the SSIP issue that you talked about. And I'll just refer to your slide 7.
Yes.
One of the things you have on there is that the typical life, I'm looking at the box on the right. The typical life of plastic pipe is 47 to 62 years?
No, the typical life of plastic is 47 years and of steel is 62 years.
Okay. So you, on behalf of AARP, are telling this commission that the typical life of plastic pipe is 47 years?
No, sir. That's what your depreciation study says.
Okay. And you're aware, the SSIP program is not proposing to replace all plastic pipe in the system.
Correct.
Montana Dakota's SSIP has targeted pre-1970 Aldelay-A plastic pipe that's been in the ground in excess of 50 years.
I'm not sure I heard pre-1970 during the testimony yesterday. I thought I heard 1971 to 1983 as the years being discussed.
Roughly in the range of 50-year-old plastic pipe that was comprised of Aldelay-A material. That's what you heard.
Well, what I heard, again, I can tell you what I heard yesterday that may not be strictly accurate, but what I heard was that there was some testing and investigation going on, and some of the pipe was from the early 1970s that the company thinks is Aldel-A, and some was from the early 1980s that the company's not sure what the material is. So just to be clear, that's what I heard. I don't know what the actual facts are.
And what you did testify to here today, Mr. Rubin, is that AARP's position is the most important factor in natural gas supply is public safety. You agree with that?
That is my position. Again, just to be clear about that distinction, I'm giving you my opinion. I hope AARP agrees with me, or I won't be working for them much longer, but you're getting my opinion.
Okay. One of the things you do agree with is the general utility rate principle of gradualism.
Yes.
Okay. Changes in rates should be made slowly so that customers' expectations are not violated.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the Allentown, Pennsylvania explosion. You said it's in your home state and your hometown.
Oh, in my home.
Or in your home, in proximity to your hometown.
Yes.
Okay. Following the Allentown, Pennsylvania explosion, and behind you, Mr. Rubin, is, and I'll just give you a copy. This is a staff advocacy exhibit, KRP1. It's attached to Mr. Pavlovic's testimony that's already been admitted in this case. But in your home state of Pennsylvania, Mr. Rubin, following the Allentown explosion, since then there's been 9 Public Service Commission orders approving rate recovery mechanisms in Pennsylvania. And I'll refer to your page 57 of 78 of this exhibit.
Sorry, I haven't counted them. Yes, I'm very familiar with the use of those mechanisms in Pennsylvania, and frankly, that's one of the reasons I'm opposed to them. It's because I've seen the effect they haven't had on safety.
Okay, and so you're critical of the Pennsylvania Public Service Commission adoption in 9 different dockets of the similar SSIP recovery mechanism.
Well, first, there's some very big differences between what's been done in Pennsylvania and what MDU is proposing here.
And that wasn't my question, Mr. Rubin.
Well, you said similar to the SSIP, and there are some very critical differences between the Pennsylvania Distribution System Improvement Charge and MDU's proposal. If you like, I can discuss them. Otherwise, I just can't answer the question the way you asked it.
Fair enough. And the exhibit in front that the commission has contains 4 pages outlining those programs and what's being recovered. Do you see that on pages 57 through 60 of this exhibit?
Yes, that's a summary of several orders that have been issued by the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission. The very first bullet in that list summarizes the authorizing legislation that set some important limits on the use of those charges and authorized the commission to use them in the first place.
Now, Mr. Rubin, I'd ask you to turn to page 29 of 78 of this exhibit.
Yes, I have that.
And if you look at Section 5.1, it says 40 states and the District of Columbia have initiated some type of pipeline replacement acceleration program. So 39 states, and they're all identified in the table we just saw, 39 states have adopted pipeline acceleration program mechanisms similar to what Montana Dakota is proposing in this case.
I don't have independent knowledge of the number. What you read is what it says here.
Okay. Are you critical of those 39 public service commissions for adopting program acceleration for pipe replacement?
There's a difference between an accelerated replacement program, which is basically the SSIP program we heard Mr. Darris discuss, and a separate rate recovery mechanism. Those are two very different things. So I absolutely do not object to an accelerated replacement program where it is needed for public safety. I have some very fundamental problems with separate rate recovery mechanisms outside of a rate case where all aspects of a utility's operations can be examined.
And one of, well, you're aware, not only AARP, but other consumer protection groups have opposed these programs in other states. You're aware of that?
Yes.
And, in fact, Mr. Kaufman and AARP introduced a resolution opposing these type of mechanisms that was adopted in 2005.
Correct.
And yet, still, 39 other public service commissions have adopted some sort of recovery mechanism.
Well, what you just read to me, and I have not read this entire document, but what you read to me says that the states have initiated some type of pipeline replacement acceleration program. It does not say that all of those states have adopted an accelerated cost recovery mechanism. Those are two very different things.
Well, one of the, as I mentioned before, one of the comparisons you made in your direct testimony was to NICOR in Illinois, Northern Illinois Gas Company. You recall that?
Yes.
I'll turn you to again to the table, page 41 of that. And in your, or are you aware that in 2014, NICOR Gas filed for an infrastructure replacement surcharge with the Illinois Commission, which plan called for $171 million in spending in each of the next 3 years beginning in 2015. Were you aware of that?
Yes, I believe I was participating in that case.
Well, then that's great, Mr. Rubin, because as we see under bullet point number two, was part of the following, it says the following projects are eligible for recovery, including pre-1973 DuPont Aldyl A polyethylene plastic pipe.
Correct.
Okay. So at least the Illinois Commission in NICOR Gas has recognized that Aldyl A plastic pipe poses a safety concern and promotes a mechanism to replace and fund it.
I'm sorry, there were several parts to that question, and I lost you because I was thinking about the first part and you were giving me additional parts. So if you could either break it down or just state it again, and I'll try to pay closer attention.
Certainly. My question was very simply, in the 2014 NICOR case, the Illinois Industrial Commission recognized the need for replacement of Aldyl A pipe and implemented a recovery mechanism for that.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that is a question. I mean, I guess you could say, is that right or something?
I think it's a question, but still compound. I think you need to break it down into two parts because I think he's making a distinction between the accelerated recovery program for pipe and the funding mechanism.
Are you aware there was a funding mechanism that called for $171 million surcharge for spending in the 3 years beginning in 2015?
Yes.
Okay. And are you aware the funding surcharge included replacement of pre-1973 Aldyl A plastic pipe?
Yes.
Okay. One of the things with respect to, I know you don't agree with the SSIP recovery mechanism, Mr. Rubin, but if adopted, you agree that to the proposed cost allocation amongst customers in Montana Dakota's tariff?
Well, I had some real concerns about the tariff language, and because in several respects it was unclear what it meant. I interpreted that tariff language to allocate costs to basically on a per customer basis, which I thought was grossly unfair and not consistent with the cost of service study. The company clarified its intention in its rebuttal testimony that it would be essentially allocated in proportion to distribution revenues, so to each customer class in that proportion. And based on that understanding, I accept that allocation method. I think some changes are required in the tariff language that was proposed to reflect that now mutual understanding.
Okay, fair enough. Still, in the context of your testimony that the most important factor is public safety, AARP is not here testifying that the 2018 service main replacement project should not be recovered in this case. Is that correct?
Well, again, I'm going to distinguish between AARP and myself.
Yep.
I have not taken a position on those 2018 projects. I understand the company has claimed them. I understand the staff experts have disagreed with the recovery of those in base rates at the present time. I do not know if AARP will take a position on that in its brief, but I have not taken a position.
You're not taking a position, and you have not seen any pre-filed testimony on behalf of AARP where they challenged the 2018 projects?
Correct.
Mr. Rubin, I have no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong.
No questions.
Let's go to Major Unsicker next.
No questions, sir.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
I just want to know how long you've lived in Bloomsburg. I'm from the neighborhood, Berwick.
Oh, well, right up the road.
Yeah,
we've lived there about 11 years. We've lived in that part of the state for, 33 years or so.
Okay, cut the chit-chat. We want to get you out of here. Okay, Commissioner Crocious.
I'll just say it's always good to meet a homie, you know? That's so, okay.
Well, I'm from Fargo originally. So not exactly a homie. But do you think MDU could get to really the projects that we're talking about for the SIP to get that rolling? Do you think they could get representative samples just through the regular course of replacement projects?
Well, I don't know. I'm not an operational person.
But you have a on the Pennsylvania District Improvement Charge, can you just summarize the differences between that, as you had mentioned earlier, and the SIP?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The first, and I think probably the most important difference, is there was separate legislation specifically authorizing that type of charge. The legislation came about a year, or I think it was less than a year, after the Allentown explosion. Understandably, the legislators were concerned. And Pennsylvania had that type of mechanism for water utilities for many years. So the legislature expanded that to specifically include natural gas and electric and actually wastewater utilities. So that's the first major difference. The second is that the legislation has a number of consumer protections in it, including requirements that the work be performed by utility employees. If it's not performed by utility employees, then it has to be inspected by qualified utility personnel. because one of the problems with the Allentown explosion is that some work had been done nearby by outside contractors who were not qualified to do the work. The work was not properly inspected by the utility. It caused some integrity problems with the distribution system, and there were some subsurface disturbance, on and on. So that's a very important protection that was put in there for consumers and for safety. Another very important consumer protection was a limit on how large that surcharge could be. Off the top of my head, I believe the limit was set at 5% of distribution revenues. So there was essentially a cap on how long the utility could use the surcharge before it would have to come in and file for a full rate case where everything was looked at and synchronized the way we're doing in this case. There's several other pieces to it. I certainly haven't memorized the entire legislation, but those are some of the most important differences between the surcharge that's used in Pennsylvania and what MDU has proposed here.
Okay. Just to go back, so the accelerated program for pipe replacement that has been referred to as occurring in, well, I thought it was 37 states yesterday and 39 today, but high 30s. Do you think this program is consistent, the program being proposed? Do you think it's consistent with those 37 or 39 other states?
We're separating the program from the cost recovery mechanism? I'm sorry, I just wasn't clear about
The cost recovery mechanism.
Okay, the cost recovery mechanism, I don't know how many states have that. It's probably in the 30s somewhere. I don't think it's all of the states that have an accelerated replacement program. And I can't pretend to be familiar with all of the ins and outs of each of those cost recovery mechanisms. I have worked in some states in addition to Pennsylvania that have them. And typically there are limits on how large the surcharge can be. So it may be capped as a percentage of revenues or as a percentage of plant investment or some way to limit the growth in the surcharge before a utility must come in and file a full rate case to make sure that all the costs are, you know, basically back in sync so that we know the costs charged to customers are reasonable. I know in Illinois, which has had a mechanism for several years, as council mentioned, one of the utilities there came under a commission investigation because of its failure to properly plan and supervise the work that was being performed, and the commission found, I think it was millions of dollars of wasted spending, and ordered a number of changes in the program. So the need for commission oversight is critically important with these programs, as well as limits on how large these surcharges can grow to make sure that you continue to have an in-depth examination of the utility's costs.
Do you think San Bruno, which has been brought up several times, do you think that's a good example? Because San Bruno is really more about improper installation.
I think it's a horrible example. The only good thing that came out of the San Bruno disaster was that it made people pay more attention to buried infrastructure. That's it. It's not a good case study for anything. First, it was a large transmission main, which, I think everyone was dumbfounded that the utility there exercised such lax control over such a critical facility. You're talking about a 30-inch gas transmission main. That's, you know, calling it a bomb doesn't even do it justice. If that isn't installed and maintained properly, it's a disaster. And any gas utility with facilities that size knows that, that the most important thing they have to do is continual inspection, maintenance, monitoring, and so on of facilities that large. So San Bruno was not distribution facilities. It was not aging infrastructure or any of the legitimate concerns we heard Mr. Darris discuss yesterday. It was just flat out utility negligence that cost, I think it was 8 people their lives and caused tremendous damage.
All right, and then finally, your top concern is with low-income households, correct? And the impact that that increasing basic or overweighting, I guess, from what that's my interpretation, to really put it in simple terms, overweighting the cost of the bill.
Sure, and not necessarily low income. I would say lower use customers.
Okay. Fair enough.
You know, I don't know the income levels of every AARP member in MDU's service area. I expect there are thousands of them, but you know, we know that retirees and especially 1- and 2-person households tend to use less natural gas than a more typical-sized family. And it's those households, the lower-use households, that are really disadvantaged by loading all of the costs into a customer charge, especially when so much of the cost is related to the demand for natural gas. So those customers, you know, who might use, say, 60 decatherms per year instead of the 90 decatherms that an average customer uses, end up subsidizing those larger use customers. And that's something we try to avoid in determining a fair rate design.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Christman.
I thought your last comment about the 60 decatherm user probably is a better example than what you included in your written testimony. I'm on page 29. You highlighted, this is your original testimony.
Yes, I have.
You highlighted the extreme examples from the residential class. I believe, well, first of all, my first question, does 91 decatherms per year sound like the correct to you as the average residential usage?
It is MDU's average, but only 30% of its residential customers use that amount of gas or more. The average is very, very heavily affected by some very large users in the residential class. I discussed that. I can't pull up the exact page while I'm talking to you, but a page or two later than that, I show that the median residential customer uses about 72 decatherms per year. So half the customers use less than that and half use more. And I would consider that to be a more typical residential customer. That average is, I mean, it's mathematically accurate, but it doesn't really reflect where most residential households are.
Okay, and I find the 72 part helpful too. But getting to this page, And let's start with the ones that bring the average way up. The about 0.1% that use 365 decatherms a year. Do you think those are really what we think of as a real residence, or do you think that that is some kind of a business that doesn't fall into another category, so they wind up taking residential service?
I honestly don't know what they are. I can speculate. It could be extremely large homes. It could be somebody running some kind of home-based business. It could be I don't know if farms are allowed in the residential class here.
I was just going to ask you, do you think farms that happen to be close enough to get natural gas and use natural gas for grain drying fall into residential?
I haven't looked at that, at those conditions in the company's tariff. Some utilities allow farms in the residential class, and some do not.
I'll follow up more with them, but I wanted to ask you while you're here, in case I have the answer. And then my other question.
And if I could just say, it could also be multi-unit buildings that are master metered or that are heated through one meter, and then the other units have individual meters for cooking or clothes drying. So I just don't know the specifics, but certainly if somebody's using 300 decatherms per year, that is very unusual for a typical residence.
And then on the other extreme, you kind of made your case by highlighting the about 1% of customers that use 12 decatherms or less. In North Dakota, do you think it's really conceivable that that is one of what you just recently talked about as one- or two-person households that would use that little gas? Or do you think that that's more likely things like campsites or summer lake cottages or little craft shops or something like that?
Well, again, I would just be speculating. From my experience, I have seen that kind of usage in for example, a multi-unit building that where heat and hot water are provided centrally through a different meter, but then each unit has a separate gas meter for its own cooking. So this could just be somebody who's only using gas for cooking, in a building that's being heated through a different meter. I don't know. But that's an example of where I've seen usage that low. I think the kind of seasonal usage you're discussing is another example of that. You know, someone who, you know, just uses gas a few months in the summer at a vacation home.
In which case it might be the wealthiest people that are benefiting most from what you're trying to accomplish.
It could be, but if we ignore those two, let me talk about the extremes. At that high extreme, somebody's using 300 decatherms per year. That is not a low-income household. I'll absolutely guarantee that because they couldn't afford it. Are they being advantaged by the current rate structure? Absolutely. Is that advantage going to low-income households? Not a chance. When we get into the middle and, you know, we look at 50 decatherms or 70 decatherms versus the 90 average, those lower use customers are likely to be either in small buildings, small housing units, because space heating is so much of the usage of natural gas, or they're going to be one- or two-person households where there just isn't that much hot water use or that much cooking, and you dry one load of clothes a week and that kind of thing. And as I showed from some of the survey data, a one- or two-person retiree household is likely to use closer to 60 decatherms per year in this part of the country. So, I think we're at those two extremes. We don't know exactly what we have. But when we get in the middle, 40 up to 100 decatherms, we've got a pretty good idea. Those are typical residential households, different sizes, different number of people in the households. And at the lower end of the scale, those customers are being asked to subsidize those at the higher end of the scale.
I wasn't going to go here to save you time, but you not stopping with your answer forced me to ask one more question. the very large users, if in fact those are categorized as residential, but if they are farms or some other type of small business, you just said they are absolutely not low income. Do you acknowledge that there can be things like farms that have a lot of dollars that come in and go out, but are really low income?
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah, okay. I may have, sorry, when I think of low income, I'm thinking of a low income residence, not a business that's owned by a low income family or group of families. So you're absolutely
right.
I'll
explore with the company some more on these other
questions. I once had a juror tell me his farm was a not-for-profit operation.
No other questions. Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Okay, I've got 10 minutes, so I'll keep it brief. Try to. Some of that depends on your answers. So. So the company, or the company, your position is... And on behalf of AARP, as hired by AARP, you agree with the revenue requirement? You don't have an issue with the revenue requirement?
No, I would not say that. I have not raised any issues with the revenue requirement. I do not know what positions Mr. Kaufman might support in brief.
And the signing to the firm... And residential agree with that? You just said that earlier.
Yes.
So can you restate your position on the rate design as it relates to customer and demand? How do you want it to be?
Sure. What I've recommended is that MDU's existing residential customer charge, that MDU's existing residential customer charge should not be changed in this case, so that any increase in revenue from the residential class should come from a volumetric or per therm charge.
Okay. So I have a little bit of a hard time distinguishing your position on the safety. You said safety is number one priority. Yet in the slide number 7.
Oh, we've lost the slide, but I have it in front of me.
Okay, it's the aging infrastructure table, the facts. You seem to be questioning the need to replace the plastic and steel pipe, that might be the vintage, replacing the vintage steel and plastic pipe isn't needed because this is the typical life. That's how I read your position. Is that accurate?
No, and if that's the impression you got, I apologize. What I was suggesting was that there's a lot of pipe out there. Some of it has to be replaced. The company has been doing that for many years without a special rate mechanism in place. It will continue to do that with or without a special rate mechanism. If this showed that, 90% of the pipe was reaching the end of its useful life, I mean, that would raise a whole host of questions. But it would also create a level of urgency that I don't think is there right now. This shows to me that, the company has been maintaining its system apparently in a safe manner over time. It adds pipe. It maintains and repairs what's there. So that for the pipe that's in place today, on average, about two-thirds of its useful life still remains. So we're not looking at some, massive or extraordinary program. Is there a problem with all delay? Yes. That seems to be what the safety folks tell us, and the company needs to investigate further to see how big of a problem it has.
So you're saying that if the company had to replace all of its steel and plastic mains, then you might see the need for something more specific in terms of a tracker or a way to recover that, but you don't see that here. It's smaller amounts, so you think it can be done incrementally like they have been doing over the years?
Yes.
And so But yet you do recognize, because you just said it, that there is a problem with all delay.
Again, I'm not an expert on that. I try to keep up with what's happening. That's what the safety regulators, I always say PHMSA, the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration of the U.S. Department of Transportation. They've highlighted a potential problem with that pipe, and I have no reason to disagree with that. So
the commission should take action with the company to address that safety concern in an effective way.
I would say that the commission should make sure the company is doing its job and keeping on top of that information, studying its system, making sure it knows what it has, and developing reasonable plans to eliminate a potential safety hazard.
Okay. And would you agree that if those issues are determined to be warrant more action than the standard approach and being a little more proactive and systematic, the commission should do that with the company, take a more proactive and systematic approach at addressing the safety concerns of the system?
If that is warranted, absolutely. As I go back to what I said at the beginning of my presentation, that nothing is more important than safety. And okay. If the company is not doing it, then you need to make sure that they do it.
And is it your position on behalf of the ARP who has hired you that you're not questioning the safety concerns that have been raised here?
Correct.
Okay. Are there any changes to the tracker that you would recommend that would make it more acceptable, or a tracker-type device that would help focus resources on improving the safety of the system?
Boy, that's a hard question, because I have yet to meet a tracker that I like, because they are very utility-focused. They're basically trying to relieve the utilities investors of the job of providing capital, but they still want to earn a return on it. As I view most trackers, they effectively turn the utilities customers into forced investors in the system, rather than waiting for a rate case and investors bearing the cost of capital during that time and earning what I consider to be very high returns on that invested capital. They're trying to almost instantly recover, or in some cases pre-recover, that investment from customers. So customers are being forced to invest in the system without receiving the same returns that an investor does and the same interest in the utility that an investor does. So I have some very fundamental problems with trackers. It's hard for me to come up with one that I would say is acceptable.
Okay.
Some are less bad than others.
Have you, since you follow this nationwide and deal in a lot of different states, have you seen cases where these types of gas replacement mechanisms, recovery mechanisms, gas pipe replacement recovery mechanisms have resulted in exorbitant rates for customers?
Yes, I referred to the situation in Illinois with People's Natural Gas Company, where rates were increasing, I don't remember exact numbers, but pretty significantly each year. And a lot of that increase was found to have been the result of the company's mismanagement. Mm-hmm. So customers were not getting value for that. If anybody had taken a look at it sooner, they would have found imprudence and the cost would not have been allowed in rates. There were just a lot of problems there. And that kind of highlighted to me the the benefits of the more traditional approach to rate making, where the utility makes the investment and then has to come in and prove that it acted prudently and that the investment is used and useful in serving customers before it's allowed to receive any money.
Okay. That concludes my questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Kaufman, redirect.
Yes. Mr. Rubin, following up on those concerns, have you also seen situations where states have adopted infrastructure surcharges that led to, even without allegations of imprudence or waste, still led the utility to reach an over-earning situation?
Yes, and that's I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's one of the other protections that's in the Pennsylvania statute, which requires the commission to monitor the utility's earnings. I believe it's quarterly. And if the utility is earning in excess of its allowed return, the surcharge is automatically reset to zero. And the utility cannot use the surcharge again until following a full rate case. So, yes, there have been instances where even though a utility is earning in excess of its allowed return, it still has these surcharges in place that, you know, bump up customers' rates even higher.
And in some of these other kind of piecemeal surcharge mechanisms, are there some jurisdictions that have adopted a requirement that they can only go on for a certain period of time before the utility has to initiate a rate case?
Yes, either
a full rate case audit.
Yes, I think there's some jurisdictions that do it based on time. There are others that do it based on the amount of dollars or the percentage of revenues, but it is not uncommon to have some limit on the surcharge that effectively requires a full rate case like this one to be filed.
And that was my next example I wanted to ask about, rate caps, which I guess may be the same thing, but are there various types of rate caps that have been attempted or implemented by other jurisdictions in these infrastructure surcharges?
Yes, and they're just different ways of trying to keep the surcharges fairly short term. I'd say typically probably around 3 years or so, at which point the utility would need to file a new rate case where everything is looked at and put back in sync.
And based on the SSIP proposal in this case and the tariff that has been recommended by the utility, are any of those type of consumer protections included?
No.
Okay. I think that's all I have.
Mr. Sanderson?
Yeah, briefly. Mr. Rubin, has the AARP or have you attempted to look in North Dakota at where the average one- or two-bedroom or lower-income homes are located?
I didn't look at bedrooms or income. I do have I'm looking at the exhibits in my direct testimony because I don't remember the exhibit number. But I did have one that looked at it's SJR 11. Looked at one-person households age 65 or older by county. Within the counties that MDU serves, now I recognize you don't serve 100% of every one of those counties, but that generally that's a one type of geographic distribution that I did look at.
Okay, and I mean, for example, in Burley County, let's just take the 563 one-person older households. Have you attempted to, or have you ever done or looked at any study in North Dakota where in the geographically those homes are typically located?
No.
Have you, or are you aware of AARP ever doing that on in any other states?
I can't speak for studies AARP may have done elsewhere. In other states, I have used this type of information and Sometimes we have the data to break it down further, but usually you can't get extremely granular with this kind of information. The census data is based on samples, and once you get down below the county level, you usually, you know, except in very large cities, you don't have a large enough sample to really make conclusions about, you know, how many customers of a very specific type you might have.
And I think kind of where I'm going with this, Mr. Rubin, have you attempted to or done anything to look at how many of AARP's low-income customers would be located in low-pressure systems in Bismarck, in Dickinson, in Minot, or other towns in North Dakota?
I do not know.
Okay. I just want to follow up. One of the things in response to Commissioner Krosch's questions was regarding legislation. You mentioned some states have adopted legislation for these recovery mechanisms.
Yes.
Have you attempted to determine how many states have adopted legislation?
No.
I just quickly went through the 39 states and the District of Columbia that were listed in Exhibit KRP-1. Then that's, again, for the record, the Department of Energy January 2017 study. And I found that only 15 of those mechanisms were implemented.
Objection. This appears to be testimony, not a question.
Sustained.
Okay. Is it your position that in North Dakota, the North Dakota legislature would be in a better position than the Public Service Commission to determine pipeline safety and pipeline recovery?
I do not have an opinion about that one way or the other. It's certainly within the legislature's province to weigh in on this if they see fit. In the absence of that, if the commission has the authority, and again, I have no opinion on that. I don't know if they do or they don't. But if the commission has the authority to do it without specific enabling legislation, then, you know, that's up to the commission to decide.
Are you aware that the majority of recovery mechanisms for these type of programs have been put in through public service commissions and not legislation?
I do not know that.
Okay. Mr. Rubin, I have no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong?
No questions.
Major Ensiker?
No questions, sir.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No questions.
Okay. Farewell, safe travels, and happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Hope you make it.
Is it 120?
106.
Oh.
So we'll see.
You may want to take the stairs, Josh. Mr. Sanderson, you have two more witnesses?
Just two more witnesses, Judge, and I think they'll both be relatively short, similar to the ones yesterday afternoon.
Okay, so how much time for lunch? 1 o'clock, okay?
That's right.
Well, we've got the elevator congestion then, right? Is that going to be okay, or should we go for like 1:10?
No, I think 1 o'clock
should be fine.
We did it in 15 minutes or 45 minutes yesterday.
Okay, all right, so 1 o'clock.